Yeah, there was Brother Arco 503. Nothing stays the same. That's going to do it for me. I'm going to just let you roll out with a little bit of instrumental. So thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoyed your 30 minutes on KBOO.FM. I will see you next week. The Lord bless you, be with you, and keep the faith.
KBOO, Portland, on 90.7 FM. K282BH, Philomath, on 104.3 FM. And K220HR, Hood River, on 91.9 FM.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. There is a psychological model called the shame triangle that really affects us all. And things like trauma, attachment wounds, and external criticism can leave us battling a sense of shame and inadequacy that keeps us from thriving personally and in our relationships. These inner struggles shape all aspects of our lives, and today we'll be talking about how to transform shame into emotional awareness that deepens connection with ourselves and strengthens how we show up in relationships. Our guest will offer a pathway for transforming the patterns that so often keep us stuck in self-criticism, shame, and avoidance strategies in order to be more fully grounded in our true self, holding wisdom, love, and authenticity. Our guest today is David Cooley, co-author of the new book, Transforming the Shame Triangle, From Shame to Love Using Parts Work. David uses the restorative conflict model and reimagines it as a tool for helping individuals learn healthier models of conflict resolution, particularly in the context of intimate relationships. He offers the restorative relationship conversation process to private clients looking for new and effective ways to address interpersonal conflict and transform it into deeper connection and intimacy. He comes from a background of restorative justice and has been trained in several modalities, including mindfulness-based practices, narrative therapy, somatic work, and attachment theory. Well, hello, David, and welcome to the Pathway Show.
Thanks so much, Paul. It's great to be here.
You know, I think we should have a show with you about the restorative conflict model as it applies to intimate relationships, because that's a fascinating and much needed topic. But that's not our topic today. Today we're talking about the shame triangle model, which your book explicates and says that it comes out of attachment theory. So can we start by asking you to explain how the shame model derived from attachment theory?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that attachment really focuses on is what we do when we feel threatened in relationship. Our attachment systems are really designed to track whether or not we feel safe and connected to the people with whom we form strong emotional bonds. And so when we feel a sense of disconnection, which can happen very quickly, you know, the case in point of interpersonal conflict, we do very particular things. There's some unique patterning that happens depending on sort of the templates that have been set and our early experiences with caregivers in particular. So we typically carry those templates with us into adulthood and bring those into our adult relationships, especially if we aren't aware of those templates and haven't done significant work on changing the patterns that go along with them. So one of the things that we often see in the work that we do with clients is that when people start to experience these attachment wounds or ruptures in adult relationships, they're playing old patterns. And often what happens for people that makes it even more complicated or difficult is we start to feel ashamed about our reactions. We think that our attachment responses to situations in real time are somehow indicative of personality traits or faults, or that there's something fundamentally wrong with us. And so that's a really painful message to internalize and layer on top of something that's already hard and overwhelming.
Okay. So are you saying then that if somebody feels or comes to the conclusion that they have an insecure attachment style, that they're liable to feel ashamed of that?
I see it often as a consequence or a symptom of, right, feeling insecure often brings about feelings of shame. Shame complicates our capacity to feel secure, even within our own relationship to ourselves, you know, and that's really what the book is about, is really starting to develop a nuanced understanding of the way that shame impacts our own lived experience with ourselves as individuals primarily, you know, and then ripples out into other relationships.
I think something that complicates it or compounds it is this whole idea that we have one, and we're supposed to have one unified self. And so if you're feeling shame, that's sort of like you're ashamed of your whole self because you only have one self. And you bring this up in the book. It's brilliant. You know, you talk about IFS therapy and parts work as a kind of a antidote to that sort of over-identification. Can you unpack that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So our work is really based in the internal family systems. And for people that aren't as familiar with that work or that model, it's really grounded in the idea that our consciousness as human beings is multifaceted or multidimensional, which means that we have these various parts of our consciousness that manifest in different moments in response to particular situations. A lot of these parts are doing different roles for us. Some are protectors, some are managers of our experience, some are firefighters trying to put out, right, things that feel overwhelming or scary or out of control. We also have what are called exiles, which are often these parts of us that are holding really deep and vulnerable pain or trauma from our past. And so these parts are often trying to protect us or help us navigate the ways that life in real time often recreates or seems to recapitulate things or situations in the past that were really traumatic or painful.
Right.
And so that's an interesting way to look at human consciousness that is different than some of the more traditional models, which sort of postulate that we are just one unified, coherent experience. And so this is helpful, as you said, when we experience conflict or something that's traumatic or something like shame, instead of totalizing the right the, everything about us and feeling completely identified with that, we can actually see, oh, this is just a part of me.
And so how does that help neutralize it or resolve it?
One of the things that it does is it creates a distance from it. It allows us to what we call externalize, right, the problem, quote unquote. So the struggle or the challenge or difficulty that we're working with, when it's just a part of us, instead of being the totality of it, it softens the intensity of it and it personifies it. It gives us a place to work and start a new kind of relationship with that part. If it's just the totality of me, then it sort of has this overwhelming monolithic quality to it that makes it very hard to approach it, right? Because I have to reconstruct or fix all of me versus working with this particular part, right? It makes it much more manageable. One of the things that helps us in this work is also, which is part of IFS as well, is the concept of self, which is in distinction to these parts. And self is a really sweet aspect of human consciousness. I like to call it the organizing principle of human consciousness. And it's the part of us that can hold parts in their activity, in their activation, in their dysregulation with compassion. It can hold all of our parts' activity without becoming blended with it. And so in that sense, it's like a witness. It's a compassionate, grounded, spacious awareness that can see all of the parts, see what they're doing, and hold this almost like a secure attachment offering caregiver or parent, right? In the many ways, we're reparenting our younger selves through the self in this work.
And can that change our attachment style? I mean, do we develop a secure attachment to ourself? And I know in IFS, that's self with a capital S.
Correct.
It's like your central identity or soul. So right, do we get a secure attachment with that? Is that the goal? Is that the benefit?
It's the opportunity or the invitation, I would say, of the work, right? It's a real transformative kind of relationship that manifests when you start to realize that there is this aspect of your being that isn't just the kind of cacophony or intensity or overwhelm, chaos of parts activity. When we start doing the work, we often recognize that, wow, I spend most of my time blended with these parts' perspective, blended with their sort of limited idea of what's going on. And so if we start to look at the different ways that parts behave or think, we can often track these different mindsets. And self allows us to step outside of those limiting paradigms, those limiting beliefs, into a more expansive perspective that gives us just so many more opportunities for agency and choice in regards to our own experience. So in that sense, we have more sense of control and thereby, I would say, more sense of security. In that sense, we could call it earned security.
Right. You know, that this is something that somebody could do within themselves or for themselves, but it seems to me that it probably is a good idea to have a therapist who understands parts work to help you lead from self and relate to these parts. But so, and we could try to model that on this show, but that'd be too much. And I think what I want to do is look at the shame triangle, which is about different parts. And you've taken the traditional drama triangle, which is perpetrator, victim, rescuer, and extrapolated from that the shame triangle. Can you unpack the shame triangle?
Yeah, absolutely. And so what we've saw is that one of the things that makes shame so challenging to unravel in therapeutic context is that it's not just a simple emotion or feeling. It's actually a complex interplay of a constellation of different parts. And what we saw essentially was that the drama triangle, which is an amazing model for mapping interpersonal conflict between people, it's also something that's been internalized within the individual on an intrapsychic level. And so if we take the different respective roles on the drama triangle, what we see is that internally, the external perpetrator is what we call the inner critic. And to be honest, I've met very, very few people that don't have some form of the inner critic active, right? Depending on the different aspects of human life that we're focused on, right? Usually there's one area of life at least where we feel some kind of inner critic. And so the inner critic is that voice that beats us up, that criticizes us, that's constantly telling us we're doing a bad job or that something's fundamentally wrong with us. And it's the voice that usually is in the second person. Like, you've done this. You are always making this mistake. This always happens. The victim on the drama triangle is shame. So we're saying that shame is actually a part within the shame triangle. And this is the part of us that collapses under the weight of what the inner critic says. And it's usually sort of the first person voice. It's like, you're right. It's the voice that believes what the inner critic says and takes on the identity of being faulty, being deficient, being unlovable or unworthy. And that's a really painful interplay between these two parts. Now, if that's not bad enough, what we have is the transformation of the rescuers internally shows up as the escapers. And the escapers can look different ways. Sometimes they're overperformers. Sometimes they're underperformers. Sometimes they're trying to project that sense of pain that's caused by the interplay between the inner critic and shame outward onto other people. And sometimes we internalize it to such a degree that we don't even want to live anymore or just sort of slowly undo ourselves through self-harm because we can't face the pain of the shame that's generated or the intense feelings that are generated by the other parts.
And addiction could be one form of that.
Absolutely. People-pleasing. What we see is that the escapers have a lot of different strategies. So overworking or numbing out, binge watching, as you said, any form of addiction. There's so many different ways. And this is often what we're seeing people show up into therapy for, is trying to manage the strategies of the escapers.
Right.
Not realizing that there's actually this more tangly, more complex interplay between these various parts of ourselves. And so what we've seen in our work is, if you're not addressing this inner critic and the way that that then collapses under the weight of a story about our identity through shame, then we stay stuck in these loops of strategies that the escapers are trying to use to get us out of the intense pain that we feel.
As somebody who personally has had an active inner critic his entire life and was brought up by a mother who thought that criticism and worry were primary forms of loving, it's hard for me to imagine that not everybody has an inner critic. You know, it's like in the IFS model, so I call it the judge. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's like I'm judging, I'm not so much anymore, but I was always judging myself and judging other people and judging reality. It was like this constant backdrop, and I tried for 20 years in therapy to kill that part, not realizing it was a part and just thinking, you know, I got to improve myself, etc. And it was in IFS that I learned, oh, it's actually trying to protect me. So all of the parts have a positive intent. And so I had to give it, the solution was to give it another job. Say, okay, you're good at judging things. Why don't you help me make better decisions? And that's what I love about IFS. That approach.
It's a very humanizing approach in that it really treats these parts of us that are holding really tender vulnerability with a lot of compassion and understanding. And so instead of approaching our parts from an adversarial perspective, which I think a lot of us have been socialized to do, we're turning towards them in a restorative way, a relational way that recognizes, these parts are something important. They're holding important information about our own lived experience. And if we can learn to be compassionate and relational, we can get that information, figure out what they're trying to do for us, validate their experience. And often what we see is that they soften and stop trying to work so hard to protect us with strategies that just don't work.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. And, you know, we have such a hard time accessing self energy, this naturally compassionate, curious, kind-hearted center of our being. We have a hard time accessing that because we feel like there's something inherently wrong with us. And it's not, we don't think of it as just a part. So I you know, is that part of what you teach is this self-centric model, how to access self when you're beset with the shame triangle?
Absolutely. That's a huge part of the work, because I think not only do we sort of not have a social context in which we're not essentially taught by our culture or society that this is something that we have access to, right? We're not a culture that has these ideas embedded in its ethos. And so a lot of people just don't know that this is something that's part of our experience as human beings. And so what we're really wanting to do is give people a lot of exercises, a lot of information in the book to help them access self. So we actually dedicate two chapters to it. And we also created a model that I think is helpful for nuancing the ways that self shows up and how to access it in more of a practical way. And so what we call the three-centered model is something that's helping people tune into where you can find self-energy throughout your being. And so we talk about how to do that through the nervous system, through the body, how to do that through the heart, through feelings and needs, specifically attachment needs, right? The relational center of our being. And then the mind, right? How do we use self-energy to really change the way that we think, the way that we story, the way that we tell our narratives about who we are as people? So we're really wanting people to have these tools that feel like are accessible at different levels. Some people have an easier time with the somatic experience. Other people are able to access self easier through the mind. So we're really wanting to give people a nuanced strategy for how to get there, because that's the starting point and point of reference that we're returning to over and over again in the work with people, right? Because that's what we're learning how to do, is stay regulated, stay calm, stay grounded, even when parts start to flare up and get activated.
Mm-hmm. And a manifestation of that is what you call the self-love triangle. And that's one of the themes of the book, is the shift from the shame triangle to the self-love triangle. So what is the self-love triangle?
The self-love triangle is a really sweet place to be, you know, and it's an opportunity for all of us to start reframing the different parts of the shame triangle. And what we're doing is we're transforming them, right? We're not getting rid of them. We're doing kind of what you said earlier. It's, we're giving them a new role, and we're teaching them essentially sort of reparenting, as I said before, these parts, letting them know that the previous strategies weren't working. So if we take part by part and look at the inner critic first, what we're doing is we're turning it into an inner coach. Right. And I like the way your personal anecdote, right, really showed the part that it's not that we've got to get rid of you. It's that we've got to teach you how to help us in a way that's really supportive versus tearing us down. So the inner critic, instead of sending out messages about how we're failing, we're using the coach to remind us what's really important for us. What do we value, and what's going to help us get there? In terms of shame, shame doesn't turn into an actual different part. We actually see that when shame starts to release its strategies, what we find underneath is what we call raw experience. It's really just vulnerability, authenticity of our lived experience as it is, without needing to be different, right? So all of the feelings, all of the needs and wants that we have as individuals that we can't allow when the story of shame is there, right, now have a place to be. And because shame's not having to defend itself against the inner critic, it's safe in our inner system for those things to be as they are. And then finally, what we see with the escapers is that they transform into inner nurturers. And so the strategies of escaping and running away from our lived experience as it is now help us turn back towards it in a way so much more supportive and sustainable.
You know, I really like the way that you point out in the book how the law of impermanence, which is one of the tenets of Buddhism, really supports this concept of parts work and the ability to evolve. And also, I think Buddhism supports the idea that you have within yourself the wherewithal to do this work, to transform, and to save yourself. And I think part of the problem that a lot of us have growing up in maybe a fundamentalist religion is we were taught we have to be rescued. We have to be rescued. We're hopeless. We were born in sin and we're liable to go to hell. It seems to me those kind of belief systems are not helping, or they're actually helping the shame triangle stay entrenched.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of social narratives that disempower people or leave people feeling as though they don't have what they need to really exercise more choice and sense of agency over their own lived experience. And so what we see is that, yeah, the constellation of parts that we're calling the shame triangle really function in a way to amplify social messages that reinforce the sense that I'm not enough. And through that I'm not enoughness, I then have to resort to something outside of myself to feel like I'm okay or that I can survive in the world. So when we see that people start to dismantle and deconstruct the shame triangle, access to a sense of empowerment and access to a sense of choice really starts to exponentially become online. And yeah, it's really exciting. It's really beautiful to see people contact a sense of self in response to their own parts and be able to respond to them in a way that feels really gentle. You know, one of the audacious goals that we have with this work actually is to genuinely turn our inner voices into our allies, our own genuine allies, instead of feeling like, right, we're fighting against our own selves in this life that's already hard enough.
Boy, that's such a worthy goal. Hey, so do you offer a workshop based on your work related to this book or anything else?
Yeah, actually, we're in the middle of an 8-week course right now that's designed to walk participants through these steps in a more kind of intimate way, you know, a guided way.
Right.
Or just it on your own with a book. So it's something that we're seeing people are really excited about, really wanting to do. I think people are resonating with the intention of this book. So we've been wanting to give people an opportunity to be in that space with us. And as you said, it can often help, especially at the beginning of your journey, to have someone who knows what they're doing help you through it initially. And then sort of as you get more comfort with it, I think people are then able to really do a lot of the work on their own.
Uh-huh. Well, it's fantastic that you're offering that, you know, a cost-effective solution for people who want to learn how to relate to themselves, how to relate to parts of themselves that can cause a lot of grief when we don't understand or we try to disown them. And what do they call that? The shadow, right? So it's been really great talking with you about this, David. I love your work, and I really, there's so much more we could explore, but today's radio show has run out of time. And I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website. One of your websites is www.restorativerelationship.com. That's all one word, restorativerelationship.com. And I encourage people to investigate your work and to buy your book, which I loved it. I got a lot out of it. And thank you again for that. And thanks for being on our show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Paul. It's great to talk to you.
Okay. For those who may have been listening to Pathways Live on a Sunday morning on KBOO and tuned in late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, and we're so glad that you were with us today. Please note that you have the ability to review hundreds of interviews in our online archive at divination.com. That's divination.com. You can play and share this particular program whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast, and I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with David Cooley, co-author of the book Transforming the Shame Triangle, From Shame to Love Using Parts Work. I want to say a heartfelt thank you to all of you listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is currently broadcast on KBOO-FM in Portland, Oregon. And you can get a free subscription to our podcast, which you can also find at divination.com or by searching for Pathways Radio on Paulo's YouTube channel, where you can give us a thumbs up and subscribe. Feel free to forward a link to your friends at the very least. This is Paulo bidding you adieu and reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Podcasts. And thanks again to David Cooley and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.
Wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday.